Welcome to the Journal of Accountancy podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. I'm Ken Titions, editorial director with the Journal of Accountancy, and in today's podcast, we are joined by Kathy Clark, a CPA who's the chief assurance officer with CLA and is based in Minneapolis. Kathy also is a member of the AICPA Not-for-Profit Advisory Council, the AICPA's Financial Reporting Executive Committee, and FASB's Not-for-Profit Advisory Committee. Kathy is going to talk with us today about the impact of FASB's new revenue recognition standard on not-for-profits. Kathy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
The new revenue recognition standard was designed to provide more principles-based guidance and to move financial reporting away from industry-specific rules. We'll talk more about it in a moment after this word from our sponsor.
Interested in increasing your firm's profitability? Check out the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Services Program and learn how to package, price, and deliver more value to your clients. Discover how at sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
FASB's new revenue recognition standard was converged with that of the International Accounting Standards Board, and it is designed to increase comparability in financial reporting across industries and jurisdictions. Kathy, what industries are seeing the most impact from the new standard, and where is guidance available?
Well, Ken, there's a lot of industries that are impacted by this. So the AICPA took a very proactive approach. They actually created industry-specific task forces for every industry that they felt would be impacted. So we had industry specific for insurance and for healthcare and for nonprofit. So, and we AICPA actually created a guide. So there is an AICPA revenue recognition guide that's available. You can get it in paper, and you can also get it online. So that is where resources are available. Phenomenal information within that guide.
I know a lot of organizations are paralyzed with where do we even start? Do you have any advice for them?
Well, and in our nonprofit space, the first thing we want to remember is that contributions are excluded from ASC 606, which is the pure revenue recognition. When we were doing the task force, one of the conversations that came out of that actually related to grants and contracts, government grants, foundation grants that we would receive. How do we account for those? And so those actually are outside of the scope of ASC 606. We're going to talk about that later. There was a new standard that came out, ASU 2018-18 came out, or 08, excuse me, 2018-08. We'll talk about that in a minute. So they're, again, outside the scope. So any of that contribution revenue and grants and contracts revenue falling in ASU 2018-08, we don't need to worry about from a 606 standpoint. However, the rest of it we do. So the first thing you need to look at is look at your financial statements. What other revenue streams do we have? And a lot of organizations would say, well, nonprofits, it's all contributions based. No, it's not, right? We have revenue streams. Higher education, tuition, fees are, again, non-contribution based. Membership organizations, dues, there's a portion that could be non-contribution based. So really inventorying all of those different revenue streams and then looking at those, asking that question, do any of those industry revenue streams go over our year end? So is any of the earnings process not complete? And if those in those situations, then we need to assess what's the impact. Materiality always comes into play with every accounting standard, but it's making sure that we're documenting that. And again, not stepping back and saying it's not going to have an impact. We need to assess. It is up to the organization to assess. Their accounting firms or CPA firms can help them. But again, management needs to make the final decision to maintain that independence. That is so important if we're having an audit done. And so, again, knowing you can reach out to your firms to get guidance and help, but your firms are really going to come in at the end and assess what you've done and validate that what you've done follows the standards and audit that piece of it. There will be an impact to every organization, regardless if there's no change in how the revenue is earned, because we're going to have extensive additional disclosures. So that is one thing that will be part of that. But again, stepping back and just looking, where's all the revenue coming from? Special events? You know, do I have a bookstore? All of those things. And again, probably don't have, hopefully, too many of those additional ones, but just walking through that one step at a time.
Kathy, can you tell us what prompted FASB to issue this clarification to the contribution guidance around grants and contracts?
When we created the AICPA Revenue Recognition Task Force, One of the, again, first duties for that task force for the nonprofit team was to go through all of the revenue streams that a nonprofit could have and see where could there be an issue. And grants and contracts popped up pretty early to say, if we have a government contract, cost-based reimbursement agreement, in the past organizations have called that an exchange transaction. Well, the exchange concept goes away. It's either under 606, so revenue recognition, which is a contract with a customer. Otherwise, you have the contribution guidance, which is, again, so you have a reciprocal transaction under ASC 606, or you have non-reciprocal, which is a contribution. And there was a lot of angst to say, well, the government doesn't give contributions. And we were trying to figure out where does it fit in the standard. And the FASB was quick to come to our defense and say, you're right. It really isn't a reciprocal transaction. The government isn't actually getting something in return. However, the standard isn't clear. And so we jumped pretty quickly to could it fall under a conditional contribution and follow that guidance. But that guidance, while it was in the standards and it existed, it was not widely used. So there needed to be a little bit of a shift and a little bit of a clarification. So again, the stakeholders sitting back saying, we need to step back and understand where these fit in and are they exchange or are they not? Are they reciprocal or non-reciprocal? And what is that definition? So the key was going back to the definition of a contribution. A lot of us in our mind have thought of a contribution as a donation. Somebody is giving me money to do something, you know, for my organization, for my mission. And the government, to my point earlier, does not give donations. But the definition of a contribution is really a non-reciprocal transaction. And so the FASB stepped back and said the key for that is understanding that that is non-reciprocal. They made a couple of key assessments relating to that if the general public is a beneficiary, that still doesn't make it, again, a reciprocal, even though it's the government's responsibility to help its citizens. The fact that the government is giving an organization, you know, funds to help the general population, that is not a reciprocal transaction with the government. So what the FASB did was they really keyed in and changed and tweaked the conditional contribution language that was out there. And really what the key thing within that standard that they issued, and it just came out in June of 2018, was they included a flowchart where they're trying to really reset people to step back and say, the first question we typically have asked in a nonprofit is it a contribution or not? And really what the first question we should be asking is it a reciprocal transaction or not? So if that answer is yes, then we go to ASC 606 and we do revenue recognition using the five-step process. If the answer is no, we jump to contribution because it's non-reciprocal. So after we answer the question of is it reciprocal or not, and we come to the it's not reciprocal, we're clearly in the contribution landscape there. Then the next question we have to ask is it conditional or not? And the definition of conditional contribution has changed. If there is a right of return and a barrier within that, so it's an and conversation now, if those two aspects exist to the transaction, it's now a conditional contribution. And if they do not exist, then you move down to, is there a restriction? And so it's really having people step through the process instead of jumping right to the conversation of is it restricted or unrestricted. It's walking through and really enhancing that conversation relating to is there a condition attached to this or not. And so that really changed. And the flowchart, again, that the FASB put together is very, very helpful, very informative on helping us walk through that.
At a high level, what is the impact of the changes? What is the new process that organizations should follow for recognizing revenue?
So again, the final ASU that came out in June really clarified and refined that existing guidance that we had out there relating to conditional contributions. The couple of things that they did step in and say was, number one, the resource provider is not synonymous with the general public. So if you're getting that government funding, again, the resource provider is not synonymous with the general public. So if we receive value, a resource provider receives value indirectly by providing societal benefit, again, it's still a non-reciprocal transaction. So again, if a foundation is giving you a grant and it's fulfilling their mission, the foundation is still, it's still considered a non-reciprocal transaction and would fall under the contribution guidance. The other concept, though, is that if the primary beneficiary of the grant or contract is a third party, the nonprofit needs huge judgment in determining if that transaction is reciprocal or not reciprocal. So when we think of Medicare or Medicaid in a hospital environment, that is actually, there is a third party that is getting benefited. The organization, it's a third party payment plan, if you will, an insurance from the federal government tied to a specific individual. That is actually a reciprocal transaction. And so is, you know, the federal funding, so the Pell grants that a higher ed institution would receive from the government tied to a specific student. So there may be some additional situations relating to that, but that is something that people have to step back and look at as an organization. Also, furthering that resource provider's mission or feel-good sentiment. So again, fulfilling the foundation's mission is not, you know, considered in that. Is it reciprocal or not? It doesn't commute. It doesn't meet that definition of commensurate value. So again, it just really updated and clarified, but what this the existing conditional contribution standard. But the amendment really requires an entity to determine whether a contribution is conditional on the basis of whether the agreement includes a barrier that must be overcome, and the and is, it's not an or, it's an and, either a right of return of the assets transferred or a right of release of the promisor's obligation to transfer those obligations. So you have to have, again, the presence of both that right of return and the release. So if you have that, you then now have a conditional contribution that you cannot recognize the revenue until the condition is met, at which time you would then continue through the flowchart and say, are there still restrictions upon this? And there may or may not be at that point. So the standard also allows this concept of if we had restrictions, but they were met at the same time as the condition, the question has been raised, do we have to then put those in restricted and then release them into unrestricted or, you know, net assets without donor restrictions? And the FASB added within this standard a simultaneous release clause that will allow organizations to have a policy to say, if the condition and restriction are met at the same period, we can treat those as, again, that it came in as net assets without donor restrictions. And so, again, it's just a policy election that an organization can make.
Great. So always good to make sure when you're following FASB standards to make sure that you've got your ands and your ors straight, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. So
you mentioned some new terms, right of return and barrier. Can you explain them and provide some examples?
Right. So let's start with right of return. That one's pretty easy. It's right of return or the concept of the release of an obligor's obligation to transfer those assets. So in a lot of our contracts with our foundations, there is a clause in there saying if you don't spend the funds appropriately, you have to return the funds. In a cost reimbursement grant, you get reimbursed based on how you spend the funds. And if you don't spend them appropriately, we're not going to send additional funding. In the past, what an organization has done, where what a lot of organizations have done, is done a probability assessment. Of course, I'm going to, you know, do those conditions. Of course, I'm going to follow the guidance. I don't want to send that money back. And so I'm going to meet all of these requirements of this agreement. But in reality, it is a legal agreement. It is an agreement that has been signed between two parties. And the organization that is receiving the funds is not in a position to step through the agreement and say that the other organization will forgive it if I don't meet the conditions, or step through it and say, from a probability, of course I will meet them. We actually have to take that at its face value and say, we cannot meet these, again, we cannot recognize this revenue until we have met the terms of the agreement relating to that. So that's where the and comes in. So it has to have that right of return. I have to send the money back if I don't spend it appropriately, or the organization won't send me the money unless I've spent it or incurred the appropriate costs. And it has to incur a barrier. Now, the barrier, there was several barriers that were put in there. There is a inclusion of a measurable performance-related barrier or other measurable barrier. That could be a specified level of service. So you're going to provide service for 1,500 individuals. That would be a specified level of service, a specified outcome. You're going to cure cancer, right? Again, a little lofty goal, but that would be a specified outcome. Matching is one that we all know. As if you raise $100,000, then you can, you know, keep this $100,000 that we're going to give you, or milestones. So that would be some definitions of a measurable performance-related barrier. There's also another barrier is the extent to which a stipulation limits discretion by the recipient on the conduct or the activity. So again, this is more specific than just the general activity conducted. So it's something that says, here's how you have to spend it, and it's more specific than how your normal mission for an organization. So if you are an organization that provides Meals on Wheels and they give you funding to provide meals, okay, that's pretty general. And it's consistent with your mission. So that wouldn't meet that stipulation of limiting the discretion. But if it said you need to deliver meals in this specific area, which maybe, again, is just a subset of your area, it's very specific and it's limited discretion on where you can spend these funds that we're giving you. That would be could be construed as a barrier. The requirement to incur only qualifying expenses based on specific criteria. This is the one that gets us all of those government grants, right? So we have the cost-based reimbursement grant from the U.S. government. They're going to give us funds if we spend the qualifying expenses. So that, again, gets us into this conditional contribution mindset because it has the, we're not going to give you the money. It has that, again, withholding of the funds, and it has this barrier, the limiting the discretion. Requirement to hire specific individuals, not just go hire five people, but hire people with these specific criteria. So again, as it gets more and more specific, that makes it a barrier. Then the third barrier is the extent to which the stipulation is related to the purpose of the agreement. So again, stipulations that relate directly to the mission or the purpose of the agreement, saying if you had an agreement that you received funding to do a research study and you had to provide a report on those research study findings, that would again be a barrier because it is a stipulation to the purpose of the agreement. Or if you're doing a building project and you had to get a specific certification, that could go to the purpose of the agreement. But it does exclude trivial and administrative stipulations and requirements, saying sending us a report on the grant expenditures, that would not be a barrier. In addition, having an annual audit would not be considered a barrier because it does not tie back to that original purpose of the agreement. The other thing relating to this standard that we need to be clear about is that the revenue recognition process is parallel for the grantor and the grantees. So if you are a foundation that's giving grants, you have to follow the same concepts to determine if you are if you're issuing a conditional grant or an unconditional grant. Again, transactions for the party that is receiving commensurate value, you're going to follow 606 if it does come back to be, again, a reciprocal transaction from that standpoint.
So even if I cure cancer, I got to make sure I do the accounting right.
Yes.
That's where CPAs, we do things the right way.
We got to follow the rules.
That's right. Kathy, some interpreters of the standard say that government grants will always be accounted for non-reciprocal. Are there any examples where that would not be the case?
So with all standards, there's no absolute, right? So the key is knowing who's benefiting from the transaction and really looking through that. Who is the resource provider and who is the recipient of the goods or services. If the answer is that the government is actually receiving something in return, then it could actually be a reciprocal transaction. So let me give you an example. Let's say we have a nonprofit organization. It's granted $100,000 by the local county, and they're granted money to do an environmental impact study relating to urban expansion. Now, if the county retains the rights to the study, then it's actually a reciprocal transaction. So the nonprofit did a study, they gave the results to the county, and the county owns those results. That would be reciprocal, that would be counted under 606. However, if the nonprofit organization retains the rights to use in the direct benefit of the county, maybe they have a mission on, you know, relating to helping with urban expansion, it's really benefiting the residents and furthering the mission of the organization, then it would be non-reciprocal. So stepping back and saying one was a direct benefit to the county, the other one is really benefiting the greater good of the county. And so that's really the difference. You know, the example that the FASB always would give is if the government contracts with Boeing for a new plane, obviously it's a reciprocal transaction. But this county example is a little bit closer to something that we would see. Same thing with if an organization receives a grant from a pharmaceutical company, and the pharmaceutical company to do research, and the pharmaceutical company actually retains the research, that's a reciprocal transaction, as opposed to if they received a grant to do it and the university actually retained the rights to the study, then it would be non-reciprocal. So it's walking through it. It doesn't matter who the resource provider is, the government or not, it's stepping through and saying, who is the ultimate beneficiary of these funds?
Great. Thanks, Kathy. How can organizations be more proactive in executing documents to get the accounting treatment they prefer?
So accountants love to do this, where we like to step through and say, well, I really want to have it to be a conditional contribution because I don't want to recognize the revenue up front, right? In a contribution, we recognize revenue today, whether it's with restrictions or without. But in a conditional contribution, we actually don't recognize the revenue until the conditions are met. So we do have organizations that say, well, how do I need to draft this to get the accounting I want? And really, it's understanding those words and language necessary for either option. The likelihood of getting a foundation to remove that right of return is probably pretty remote. And because, again, their legal counsel is telling them we need that in there just in case, you know, those bad actors that are out there. So we really need to understand that we're not likely going to get rid of that. But it's really sitting down with your grant provider and saying, can we document the conditions within the agreement, the stipulations within the agreement, to maybe make them a little more vague so that they don't meet the definition of a barrier, or more specific so that they do. So it's really understanding what the standard is and walking through and saying, what is the accounting? Because a lot of times the grants are not written by the accountants, right? They may be written in the grant office where they don't understand the language. So it's educating our grant writers and even those individuals on our teams that are, you know, asking for grants. So understanding how those little words, because words do matter, what those different words can, how they can impact the accounting. And at the end of the day, stepping back and saying, regardless of the accounting, the economic impact is the same. We've received the funds. You know, regardless of how it's accounted for on the GAAP financial statements, we can explain all of that in our financial statements, in our footnotes, and let our readers of our financial statements understand where the funds are coming from and when they'll be available if it does come through as conditional. So not getting so hung up on the accounting that you don't miss the fact that the economic impact is the same and that we have received the funds that we need to further our mission.
Can you tell us more about the revenue recognition effective dates?
For entities calendar year 2018, if an organization had issued or is a conduit debt obligor for securities that are traded, listed, or quoted on an exchange or an over-the-counter market and serves, if they had that conduit debt obligor, the standard was effective for 12/31/18 or June 30/19, if you're, you know, fiscal year end. So again, if you don't have that conduit debt, it would be effective for December 31st, 2019, and then the fiscals in 2020. So it is, for some of our clients, we are actually adopting it now at this time. And again, which is key because we do now have that GOT resource guide to provide us for that. The ASU 2018-8 came out in June of 2018. And we were trying to tie the effective date. We knew this guidance had to come out before the effective date of 606, before people had to actually issue 606 for the first, under 606 for the first time, because it impacted the grants and contracts piece of it, which is a huge revenue stream for a lot of our organizations. However, because it did come out in the middle of the year, it wouldn't really be fair to make organizations that had that conduit debt that were already early adopting come up to speed on this new standard and actually adopt that standard as of 12/31/18. So the FASB actually stepped back and said that for those standards, it will be for annual periods. For June, starting the first effective date will be June 30th, 2019 for that standard, and then any fiscal year ending after that period. So June 30th, 19 will be the first time grants and contracts. What they also put in for the grants and contracts was they actually have a little bit of a transition guidance for when you have to do that, because knowing that grants have multi-years. A lot of our grants will have multi-years. So the effective date should be applied to agreements that are not completed as of the effective date. So again, so any grant that's still open, you need to apply it to that or entered into after the effective date. So any grant where you've already completed your revenue cycle, you don't have to go back and look at that. But if you have a grant where you've maybe only received 2 of the 3 years, that third year you need to go back and look at and say, how would I record this under the new standard? You don't need to do any retroactive. It's a going forward. It's a prospective standard. But you do need to look at any open grants. And that is really the only piece of it that changes.
Kathy, this has been great information. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd also like to thank our audience for listening today. For more information on not-for-profit accounting and financial reporting topics, visit the AICPA not-for-profit section at aicpa.org/NFP. And for more information on other topics and trends affecting the accounting profession, please visit journalofaccountancy.com or Podomatic.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.